This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
Joy 94.9, this is the Escape Hour. We're going to Nepal today, but Stefan, before we go to Nepal, you are going to tell us all about that silly old airline, Cathay Pacific.
Well, Cathay Pacific, marketing ploy or genuine error. They misspelled the name of their own airline name on the side of the plane with Cathay Pacific. So no F.
Did you see that, Pete?
I did see that. I thought that was pretty quirky because F is the best letter in the alphabet, as we know.
Meth is his. Now, did you think that was a marketing ploy?
Well, I didn't to start with, and then thinking about it, I thought probably, because it got so much publicity.
Yes.
That,
I don't know, is that really good publicity for airline? I mean, if you forget an F, what else do you forget?
What are you going to do?
It's so easy. I mean, those things, those templates, they are all, you know, computerized and thing, and it's not somebody coming up with a pot of paint.
Well, I think it was a good marketing idea. On every radio station, every TV channel, it's on every social media, so interesting stuff. Mm. But, you don't want them to forget their engine or a pilot or something.
Well, not at all. Absolutely.
Now, I cannot believe Stefan's news today. I just about fell off my chair when he told me that.
Outrage.
Oh, I'm outraged too, Stefan.
Absolutely.
Qantas is taking music off its entertainment.
Well, clearly no one was listening. I mean...
This is their claim.
Look, they do have... there's Qantas Business, I believe, where business people talk about business stories. But most people... Really, they're going to bring their own music.
It's not just the radio channel. It's also the on-demand music that you can program through the internet.
Everyone comes on with their own music anyway.
Yeah,
so
that's true, but...
Yeah, well,
No great loss.
Okay, well, I like to go to sleep with my headphones on, listening to Qantas music. They're Best of Australiana and puts a tear in my eye as I'm flying through the sky.
My mother about that. She will love the Best of Australiana.
Oh, such a beautiful show.
She won't be able to listen to it anymore.
I don't know if she would know how to work the radio thing.
Understand. Yes, yeah, so I do listen to it. But Stefan was saying, and quite interestingly, is this the end of in-flight entertainment, or is everyone just going to bring on their own entertainment from here?
There's quite a lot of talk about this because it adds a lot of weight to planes.
Yeah, but then there's the weight of everyone else's appliances.
But they're taking it regardless already.
Well, you have to take,
Phone, you got an iPad, you got a computer. Yeah, it adds a little bit of weight. It's probably less weight than, 400 seats in flight entertainment system. And in terms of fuel, it's... reduces the fuel bills and it's
well,
more
well, I think you and I both know
ethical.
That Fiona only needs a bottle of champagne for her in-flight entertainment and she's
exactly
as happy
right.
as Larry, aren't
you? Totally.
That's the one.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLD, TIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You're on Joy 94.9 on this Stunnerama afternoon. This is the Escape Hour. Namaste. Is it namaste? Namaste, I believe. Namaste is correct. Fiona Brooke, you introduce this amazing guest of ours, please.
Stephanie Woolard, founder and CEO of Seven Women,
woohoo!
Which if you just do yourself a favour, get onto your search engine of choice and Google Seven Women. Stephanie founded Seven Women at the age of 22. Thanks for coming on, Stephanie. We want to hear all about your journey and Nepal.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. So you're a Melbourne local, but you travel to Nepal many times. I mean, how many times have you been now?
I've been, I think, 35, 36 times now.
Wow.
In the last 12 years.
That's extraordinary. So tell us the story of Seven Women and how it came about. It is a great story.
Yeah, so I was quite a curious young person and wanted to get out there and see the world, as many young people do. And I'd had an experience when I was in year 10. Mum and Dad pulled me, my brother and sister, out of high school for 6 weeks and we took a caravan and headed up the centre of Australia and down the east coast and stayed in a lot of random towns and, the outback, Oodnadatta, Tennant Creek, Coober Pedy, and that I suppose, exposed me to some of the social issues that we have here in Australia, and some amazing, inspiring Aboriginal people that I met. But also at nighttime, sometimes there was, you know, violence and screaming, and from Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal communities. And that's, you know, as a 16, 17-year-old, that really got me curious as to why these people are behaving in this way. And so that set me off on a bit of a path. After high school, I stayed in two Aboriginal communities, one with an anthropologist from La Trobe Uni who had a bit of funding to take three students up. So that was Doinji, a tiny homeland community. And that really shaped who I am today and what I'm passionate about, and social justice and equality. And the second one was with Red Cross Remote Communities Holiday Program. So that was in Daly River. I really wanted to work in you know, Aboriginal issues and in those communities, but at the time, you know, there was a lot of red tape and couldn't see a way for me at that young age to do that. So was really curious to travel overseas to a developing country. Didn't know where, or, you know, didn't have Nepal in mind, but I had a family friend who suggested Duke of Edinburgh trips. So that's how I found myself in Nepal on a volunteering trip at the age of 19.
How incredible. Understand where you're coming from. I was an exchange student overseas. I think, were you an exchange student as
no,
well?
No, I wanted to be one. My mum wouldn't let me.
Mark Adams was an exchange student as well, our other Joyster. And it is an experience that you never forget, and it does shape you. Nepal is not on many people's list to go to at that age, and you must have been absolutely godsmacked by what you saw when you arrived there. It's a different world, isn't it?
It was just the most amazing experience. I still remember the feeling of, you know, arriving at the airport, which was, you know, I remember the beepers were going off as we took our luggage through, and, you know, no one was manning the security thing, and I was like, do we just walk through? So we walked through, and then just the bus ride from Kathmandu Airport to our hotel, you know, my eyes were so wide open, just like, oh my goodness, look at all this activity on the streets and all the colour and the vibrant locals who were all doing their little thing in the little shops. And I just thought, oh my goodness, this is like another world. And I was quite a disobedient to a group member. I was you know, our task was to lay the foundations of a school in one of the remote communities, and I, you know, got so bored with just digging with the shovel. I kept escaping off into the local people's houses having tea, and really curious to meet, you know, as many people as I could and to learn the local culture. So I feel a bit guilty. The group leader, Trent, at the time was saying, you know, Steph, you're going to give me a heart attack. Just, I don't want to know where you're going. Just tell me you'll be back by sunset. So I really felt that connection to the people, because they were incredibly hospitable, and despite having nothing, just so incredibly generous. And that spirit of generosity, you know, has really inspired me. The Seven Women the Seven Women organisation started when I stayed on. I went back to Nepal as a leader for groups of architects through Duke of Ed, co-leading groups, and stayed on for 2 weeks after one particular trip, and walking down the back streets of Kathmandu, trying to, you know, learn more and meet more locals, saw a very disabled woman who was walking a few metres ahead of me, and she was carrying two heavy bags, and kind of turned into this tiny tin shed, and, you know, being my curious self, sticky nose, walked behind her and saw that there were seven disabled women who were, you know, living and operating in this tiny corrugated iron tin shed. And one of them spoke broken English and basically said that they're living in the tin shed because in Nepal there's a belief that you are evil in a past life if you're physically disabled in this life, and found that incredibly sad, as anyone would.
Yeah.
And then, you know, thought, what can I do? What can one person do to help this situation?
Wow. So,
yeah, that's really very powerful story. What's the aim of Seven Women? So you created Seven Women based on seeing this woman.
Yeah, so the whole kind of mission behind Seven Women is, you know, the driver is equality and social justice. But what we do to achieve that is education, skills training, and income generation. So Seven Women today, 12 years later, is we started as a manufacturing. I had about $200 left, so I paid for the women to have two Nepalese trainers to train them in skills. Oh. So I started producing knitted products that really didn't sell in the Australian market for the first few years. But today, 12 years later, Seven Women's a manufacturing business that exports globally and to Australia, employs over 1,000 women. A cooking school in Kathmandu. So we have daily, Intrepid, World Challenge and World Expeditions, the main tour companies bring their travellers to learn how to cook from the women. So it's really empowering for the women to be able to share their local knowledge. It's not, giving handouts and freebies to these people that we see as poor. And the third enterprise is a tour company. So I've created a responsible tour company that takes high school students, university students as a subject, and the general public over to have those deeper immersive experiences in a country like Nepal.
And that type of responsible travel is very big these days. It's I was talking to my partner only this morning about how travel is changing so much now that it's not just about people buying an airline ticket and getting some accommodation. What the general population is after now are experiences, and certainly what you're offering would be right on the mark from a marketing perspective. But at the same token, if someone was wanting to help someone in another country, that's what your tours will be all about, I would imagine.
So what is responsible travel? What makes it responsible compared to what Russ was saying about buying an airline ticket and turning up?
There are just so many different types of responsible travel, and it's really I will mention Intrepid because they have a foundation, and they are one of the most obvious companies in Australia as a whole, that they donate to many of the communities in many of the countries that they visit, and they do a wonderful job, and their tours in particular are experiences and where you are certainly eating with families and you would be travelling on public transport. You are, you would be visiting places where manufacturing occurs, and so you can actually help a community rather than I don't know. It's interesting. I took a trip to India this year, and we specifically chose a guide in Mumbai to take us into the slums, where we knew that everything we did there was going to go back to the community. Because we're talking about a population of 1 million people that live in the slums in India, and there are just tour groups going in and out of the slums all day, all night, but these are people's homes and this is where people live. So we stopped, we ate in a restaurant inside the slums, we bought a pair of shoes from a manufacturer in there, we certainly donated to a kids' orphanage in the slums, and this is what responsible travel is all about. But I'll let Stephanie talk about that more because it is a very passionate subject.
So I think, in basic terms, responsible travel, and it's over the last kind of decade or so, it's moved from ecotourism to sustainable travel to now the new term is kind of responsible travel. But in basic terms, just respecting environment and the people in the places that you're visiting. So making sure that you don't, when you trek Everest, you don't throw your plastic water bottles off the side of the mountain, which, has been a problem in the past in Nepal, and that you choose the alternative, which is to have your own bottle and refill it and use the aqua tabs, or as one simple example. But if you're going to spend money as a tourist, how can you spend money at local enterprises and support fair trade initiatives created by women, like you were saying before, instead of supporting the chains? And there is a pretty alarming statistic which says in all the travel in developing countries, out of $100, only $5 sticks with the local market and stays.
Oh, that is a remarkable statistic.
Imagine with the increase in travellers that we see. Apparently, there's 1.3 billion in 2015. In 2050, it's said to be 4.3 billion people that are travelling. So, it is really important that we start to think how we as tourists can be conscious and be aware. Which I think that shift is definitely
apparent. Yeah.
Well, in a place like Nepal, which would be suffering from over tourism, well, this is like going onto another tangent, but the effect of the earthquake in Kathmandu must have had a massive effect on some of the organisations and the people that you work with. Mm. Was there anything in specific that you did to kind of counteract the negativity around the earthquake?
I think that's a really interesting example of, you know, and something I've spent the last decade studying in detail is how, you know, especially in a natural disaster situation, how do we make sure that we're supporting and uplifting and still kind of empowering as much as possible in the panic that happens rather than giving things for free? So, and there's always, you know, there's always the potential of doing damage, but one example in the villages that we worked in were, you know, they were getting so much rice, they've never had that many bags of rice before ever. So because there were so many aid organisations giving things for free, they started to make rice wine, and that started to create a huge problem, you know, in that community, which you can understand they probably didn't foresee that happening because they didn't even know rice wine was a thing. But going back to your question, you know, after the earthquake, there are a lot of different operators in there and a bit of a lack of coordination of efforts. Mm. There was also the corruption, you know, the Prime Minister's Fund was created, which they said all aid money had to go directly into that fund, and that still hasn't been fully
given out yet.
No. But, yeah, so at Seven Women, we had donations from all over the world and kind of siphoned them off into immediate aid, short-term and long-term, because, you know, it's really important that when it goes off the news that there's still activity happening, that there's long-term funds there to stick with the communities until they get back up and running.
I've missed my favourite show on Joy. What do I do? What do I do?
Podcasters to battle!
Joy podcasters fight on tirelessly to bring you the best bits of every show. So if you've missed something recently on Joy, don't worry, our podcasters have your back. Head to joy.org.au and click on the podcast tab or look us up on iTunes. Podcasters on Joy 94.9, fighting tirelessly for your listening pleasure.
So, Stephanie, now, I mean, I must imagine that when you walked into that tin shed and then offered to help the women with your last $200, how did they react to that? I mean, were they like, who are you? Or, you know, what was that like?
Yeah, I think their reaction was a little bit strange. I remember one of them said, yeah, they thought I was God because they're deeply religious in Nepal. So, you know, to me, that was a bit strange. And so, but they were extremely grateful because they were, living in such squalor at the time. They really appreciated it. And I knew that from the beginning, I didn't want it to be a handout because that wouldn't actually help the women after I, you know, took off back to Australia. I wanted it to be building their skills or building something in them that they could carry forward and take control over their own lives. So,
and you were 19 when you did that.
So I was 19 when I first went to Nepal, and I went back to help lead the groups when I was 22. Gosh. So I met them when I was 22, and it was really interesting. That question reminded me of a board member that we had in the very beginning, the first couple of years, called Ganesh, who was, you know, really, really sceptical and curious about why I would want to help, which I kind of understood because in Nepal they don't have that luxury. They're so busy, you know, trying to provide their basic daily needs that the you know, the volunteering isn't a concept over there, and they just don't engage in volunteering. So, yeah, he kept asking me, like, but why do you want to help? And it's, you know, to me that's part of who I am, and I've been brought up like that. And it's, you know, why wouldn't you if you had the capability and an opportunity to do something? And I had a bit of money left and had a roof over my head back in Australia, still lived with the parents at 22. So so that was kind of the initial reaction of the women. But the women were incredibly grateful and really took every single thing that they learnt to transform their lives and earn money.
Where are they today?
So six of the women still work with us, and one of the women has been married. That was quite a few years ago now, probably about 6 years ago, and training other women in her village. Oh, so cool. We hear about her journey through the other women. They're still connected. But they've taken on managerial roles at the centre. So, you know, house maintenance
That's
manager.
Amazing. And what sort of things do you manufacture?
So silk scarves and silk dressing gowns and lots of different accessory items created from recycled silk. We also do knitted, you know, beanies and scarves and hand gloves and also children's toys created out of felt.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. And most of those products are available. Obviously, you can buy them from the centre, but do any of them make it to Australia?
So I've been importing the products for the past 12 years and wholesaling to shops.
Fantastic.
We're just starting to kind of stop that and move it all to Nepal, so link up major buyers directly with our Kathmandu centre. Nice. Okay. To kind of make it more sustainable, and the me importing the products was only ever to, you know, get the initial funds
into the organisation.
Yeah, so we always had kind of sustainability in mind since the beginning, and that's now finally happening. So we don't need to sell products here anymore.
Stephanie, another part of this show that you may not know about is we are the food and travel show. Tell us about food in Nepal.
Yeah, so I'll also talk about the cooking classes that we do at the centre, because we started those cooking classes to create local income for the women and allow them to share their culture of food, which is so crucial to Nepalese people. Mm-hmm. They eat two meals a day called dal bhat. So dal is the lentil soup, mm-hmm. and bhat is the rice, Nepalese word for rice. That's basically their meal, their whole diet, two dal bhats a day, where they have a variety of different little curries. They have the lentil soup, and then they might have, you know, mutton or goat curry, and then the vegetable curries that are on the side.
What sort of vegetables are mostly common in Nepal? I have a sense of potatoes in my mind, but I might be wrong. I don't know where that
lots
came from.
Of potatoes. Yeah, lots of potatoes. That's kind of the staple diet. They have a lot of spinach, and meat is seen as something that wealthy families can eat. So there's goat, and then there's, you know, pig is not so popular, but there. Buffalo. Buffalo is popular.
That's interesting, because cow is obviously very sacred, being a Buddhist or Hindu country. So they can't kill cow.
No.
But buffalo's okay.
Yeah, buffalo's okay.
Funny, because, you know, buffalo looks just like a big cow
to
me.
Yeah.
Splitting hairs.
As a side note, Fiona, you're a foodie. Do you know any Nepalese restaurants in Melbourne?
I believe there are a couple of Nepalese restaurants in Melbourne. I can't recall them offhand, but I will definitely
My friend runs one in Base Camp in High Street, Northcote,
fantastic.
Yeah, so they have great
tip,
so,
everyone.
Yeah. Before we head over on the tours, we take the groups there for a bit of a food experience, Nepali food experience.
So it's authentic?
Yep.
That's fantastic.
Awesome. That's
cool. Do they serve buffalo?
Yep.
Oh, cool. Okay. Out of curiosity, I know the average Joe Blow would think Nepal, Kathmandu, Mount Everest. Okay, so that's, you know, in fairness to most Australians, they're the iconic places. But I know anyone who visits there and gets out of those places and goes to little towns really are gobsmacked by the experience there. Would you agree that it's get out of Kathmandu and see as many of the smaller towns as possible?
Definitely. I think a lot of people go to Nepal, Everest, as you said, and go trekking, but that's quite a well-worn route now, although it's still, you know, amazing to do that trek. I think Annapurna is the other mountain range that's less mm-hmm. touristy and, you know, more stunning, in my opinion. Mm. But also, you know, Nepal has so much more other than the trekking in the mountains. The people are among the most beautiful people I've ever met, and I've done a lot of travelling in the world, and I think, you know, it's the culture and the people that really stick with people. Mm. A lot of people that travel to Nepal go back a number of times, and it's the people that really stick. So there's so many stunning little towns and villages, but you know, Nepal's still a place that is not fully developed for tourists in some of these areas. So I really recommend, you know, if you want to go to Nepal and have the cultural immersion or that experience, to go with a boutique tour company, because, right, you know, if you go with a big one, they are dealing with, you know, mass en masse customers. So right. it does, you know, I'm always a big believer of the smaller operators still allow those amazing local experiences that they can't, you know, hammer with tourists one group after the other. So, the smaller organisations that have deep connections and have been going there for many years is an incredible way to travel.
And I think that's a good tip with travel wherever you go. I mean, if you're going on mass, you'll find that your tour guides are only interested in taking you to certain places because they're going to get a kickback and a commission. Mm. And it's such an industry all over the world that savvy travellers or smart travellers are the ones who are looking more at this responsible travel that we were talking about before, where you are going with small boutique companies where you're actually getting right in to meet the people and give back to the people. So, I think... What brought around your idea of running tours for students? That sounds really amazing to me.
Yeah, so I was at university when we started Seven Women. I'd come back from Nepal and was looking for a place to sell the product. So I set up a stall at my university on campus, and I was doing an undergrad in international development, and just found it so valuable to have that lived experience to relate what I was learning to. So wanted to share that with other students. But I started the tour company after a friend of mine wanted to do a documentary on Seven Women. So I kind of jam-packed all the amazing experiences that I'd had that enriched my life so much into a 10-day itinerary to take him around so he could film everything. And that impacted his life quite profoundly.
Wow.
And he sent me an email after it. And then I just, you know, light bulb moment, maybe I could make this into an opportunity for others to share with others. So now university students can come as an accredited subject. It's called Challenging Global Perspectives.
Well, that is a fantastic.
So it's a bit of everything. It's a bit of visiting different organisations that are leading in their area, environment, human trafficking, which is a huge issue in Nepal, an organisation called Mighty Nepal that we visit, and Seven Women as an example of social enterprise, as well as the main, you know, the temples and the World Heritage Sites in Nepal. But the tour is kind of the glue that sticks it together. Is so many different locals are woven in and out of every day activities that people get a really deep sense of the culture and the people.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You're on the Escape Hour with Stefan on the decks. We've got Russ on the mic, and we also have our special guest, Stephanie Willard, founder of Seven Women, who is giving us a fascinating insight into Nepal, but not only into Nepal, but into her incredible organisation and the people that she helps, the different communities. When you go, I mean, you've been to Nepal how many times this year?
Oh, so this year twice.
Do you have a must visit place every time, aside from, you know, obviously visiting, you know, your centre and the women? Is there a must visit place that you love to go?
Oh, my favourite place is Baldinath Stupa. It's a Buddhist temple. It's like a mecca for, you know, Tibetan Buddhists and Buddhists from all over Nepal, and it's just one of those places that, you know, there's Hindus that come, there's Muslims that come. It's just a really beautiful atmosphere, very peaceful, and you see all the Buddhists kind of spinning the prayer wheels that that line the outer ring of this huge temple, that, you know, and they believe that when they spin their prayer wheels, their prayers go up to heaven.
Uh-huh.
So it's you know, you can feel that sense of gratitude and people basically praying, so it's the atmosphere that I love there, and there's always a buzz of lots of different people.
Whereabouts is that?
So that's in, it's about half an hour out of Kathmandu, the main area that the tourists stay in, called Tamil, and it's called Boulder.
Are you into meditation? Is that something that you enjoy doing, Stephanie?
I've tried it a number of times and have never really got into it, but I was at a conference last week called Wired for Wonder, and they had an amazing Aboriginal guy speak there about his meditation practice that sounds like it's getting a lot of traction. But his whole philosophy is, if we're not connected to the land, then we're not connected. It's hard for us to feel connection. So he's created an amazing meditation that connects us for 15 minutes to the land, to the animals, to each other.
Wow.
That basically acknowledges, you know, the earth, the oceans, the, you know, fire, air, water. So it's called Wayapa Work. And I've signed up for his online course. So I think, you know, there's hope. There's hope for me.
I know, we'd all like to be able
signed
to...
signed up.
We'd all like to be able to meditate and find some sort of inner peace, but, I'm hearing you.
So we were, interestingly, Nepal has some of the most advanced LGBTIQ rights in the world, which is really fascinating. Mm. Now, they don't have legalized same-sex marriage, but they have a lot of other rights that are enshrined. So there's a great deal of accessibility and openness towards it on a sort of government or political sense. Mm. However, from a day-to-day point of view, it's still a very conventional society, and locals are expected to, you know, marriage and conventional family life is the norm. Mm. What's your experience with the people, people of who are more diverse and of queer people in Nepal?
I've had very limited experience, actually, and it's very surprising to me to hear that. I wasn't aware of that, but it reminds me of the, they've got high quotas of women and quite progressive on paper with gender equality, but you look at the society and you live there and, you know, we get so many women coming to the centre that is not their experience. So I think it's one thing to have, and it's very surprising to hear that, but it's not my experience of Nepal that they would be embraced and accepted, and it's, you know, there's a big transgender community in Nepal.
Is there?
As there is, you know, in a lot of different countries like Myanmar and Thailand and... I don't feel like it's embraced, and people are.
Stefan's got the stats on.
Well,
that,
no, I've got. Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's in the legislation, you know, you can display your preferred gender on your identity card. The gender non-neutral term, like male, female, son, daughter, should be substituted with gender neutral terms. There's protection from discrimination. So it's really progressive in the legislation.
That's very, very progressive. And I've actually got my friend who's a human rights lawyer over there, Dinesh Tripathi. He's been involved a little bit in this, and also in the gender equality and in the progressive laws and the constitution that was finally written a few years ago. So there are little sections in the constitution that are incredibly progressive,
but it doesn't translate.
It has to start with a law, obviously, because so then the advocates can, you know.
And that's only, it was in 2007, so it's not, 11 years is not long to change societal attitude toward it. I mean, 11 years is nothing, so you probably will need more.
Well, my interesting reading around all of that was that still 90% of the population are in pre-arranged marriages. Mm. So I the legislation certainly sounds fantastic, but what you were just saying about, actually, in practice, if people's marriages are still pre-arranged, then it would be very difficult to be that accepting of... Of GLBTI community. Mm. Is that something you've seen, or
I suppose understanding the how village communities work and the dynamics, and having seen how discriminated against disabled women are, and also the caste system which exists in Nepal. Yeah. So, you know, the Brahmins are the top caste, and then the Dalits are the lowest rung on the caste system, and then, you know, disabled women are kind of completely off the caste system. But what's been really interesting and kind of relates, but not really, but, you know, the money is obviously a big thing in Nepal. So these women that are disabled, once they start to earn money and economically empowered, it's been phenomenal to actually see them almost jump to the top and be listened to and respected and in their communities. So the caste system is kind of, you know, null and void then to a certain extent. So, you know, that
so what you're giving people power, which money talks.
And a voice,
exactly,
which is crucial. So, I'm not too familiar with the LGBTI community in Nepal. It's certainly something we haven't really seen, because I think it's very hidden in a society like Nepal. But it's great to hear that those laws are there, so that advocates can, you know, drive progress, hopefully.
And we do tell everybody on the show when they're visiting Southeast Asia to be very respective of local laws and local communities. Mm. That you know, we're very progressive here in Australia and places like the United States and the UK. But you know, Southeast Asia is you need to be very mindful of their religion and how they. One of the things that I love about that part of the world is men holding hands just as friendship. And for me, it's sort of like.
I was going to mention that.
You know,
yeah,
it's just so beautiful to see.
It is, that human connection. And I remember my first trip when I was 19, being on the bus, you know, heading, and there was a few guys on the bus that were helping the driver, and they were holding hands and they kept kind of, you know, arms around each other. And I thought, oh, that's, wow, that's great that, you know, they're gay, obviously. Yeah. But they weren't. And then, you know, you see on the first trip, it took me, you know, a while to figure, oh, my God, they're just, you know, they're really touchy-feely friends. In this
good friends.
Country. Yeah, they're just good friends. Mm, so it's so different. And it was hilarious because I took my family's been over a few times now, but my brother, who's, you know, not very comfortable or used to being, you know, having his hand held. You know, when we went over into the village, the young kind of, you know, the teenagers that I knew there, they were so delighted to see my family that they held my brother's hand. They were, you know, skipping and swinging their hands down the hill, and I could just see how uncomfortable my brother was, thinking like he was got a shell shock, didn't know what to do, and my dad,
did you
the same
laugh?
Thing. Yeah, loved it. Yeah, me, mum, and my sister were laughing our heads off. Yeah,
that's fantastic. Yeah. So it's so cheap to go to Nepal these days. You can get airfares for, you know, $699, $700. You, again, have been very helpful to our listeners today by telling them to look for companies that are small, boutique, responsible travel, which we absolutely love. When's a good time to go to Nepal?
I think, you know, there's a lot of months in the year that it's great. March, April, and September to November is kind of great for trekking. I take groups in June, July, which is just kind of after or a little bit during the raining season, but it normally rains at night, and that's my favourite time of year because it's very green and the air's clear because it's been raining, then December, January for the uni students. There's, you know, it's different in different months, but for trekking, definitely kind of September, October, November, March, April.
And for those people like, you know, Fiona and myself, we're travellers, but how would you prep for a trek like that? Because certainly, I mean, I think I'd probably, you know, want to be carried up the hill by a Burka, really.
Yeah, Sherpa.
Sherpa, excuse me. Got that wrong.
So you can, you know, the Sherpas, that's their job. They can carry people's packs. My auntie's just gone over without the treks that we do and with her friends, and they had Sherpas each that carried their packs so they could just relax and look out for the leeches on the path. So the Sherpas are fantastic, and they you know, they're incredibly strong.
Right, and they've just lived their whole lives there. Yeah. Stefan, you've got some messages that have come in this afternoon.
Yes, we've got a message from Wayne telling us, how inspiring is Seth Woolard? You're an amazing human being. Keep doing what you're doing. Love you heaps. So that's,
I think I know Wayne. That's awesome.
And we had a new member earlier
and
today.
We had a new member, Umit Sahin. Umit.
Yeah, that's right.
Joined. Thanks, Umit, for joining. And
welcome, Footscray. We've got a new member from West Footscray. We love that. That's awesome. And
there's some great food in West Footscray.
Oh, I tell you what, it's a beautiful part of town and an affordable part of town to live. It is too.
And if you want to join, you can head to the website on joy.org.au, and there's great deals for membership. Individual membership is $84. Family, $124.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLB, TIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You're on the Escape Hour. We are winding up the hour with Stefan on the decks and Russ on the mic, and our lovely guest, Stephanie Bullard from Seven Women, an inspiring story. And I'm very interested in the responsible tours that you take. I might go and sign up for one myself.
Yes.
Now, we do have it's come to that part of the show where we have to ask Stephanie the question.
The question.
So, Stefan, would you like to ask Stephanie the question?
Well, I think with the type of travel Stephanie does, we probably know the answer, but do you fall or roll?
Do I what? Sorry?
Do you fold or roll?
Fall or roll?
Fold.
Okay.
Fold or roll.
I don't do either. I just chuck everything in.
She's a stuffer.
And zip it up.
Maybe we need to ask
We
this.
Haven't had a stuffer on before, have we?
No, we did actually. I'm pretty sure we had a stuffer recently.
This is the second stuffer we've had.
This is the second stuffer. Oh, yes. Yeah, can you remember? Was it David Gale? Was a stuffer. Yeah, exactly.
So you have to stuff when you go to Nepal, I understand. So that's interesting.
That's an option we need to add.
All right, stuffer or roll, okay. Steph,
thank
why should
you.
We go to Nepal in a quick sentence or two?
Okay, Nepal is just such an incredible place that I think you know, activates the heart as well as the head, and just, you know, the heart is the most important these days, I think, when people travel, to open your mind up. And really, Nepali people are some of the most beautiful people I've ever met in my life, so it's absolutely a place you need on your bucket list. It will, you know, transform hearts and minds.
People, wow. And that's really what travel is all about, is the people and experiences. So you've been so inspirational today, and I'd love to have you come back on the show and talk about more of your trips to Nepal and other places you've been to, because you're so worldly travelled. So thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Fiona, where are we going next week, if you don't mind me?
Oh, it's a surprise guest.
Oh, surprise. We're always full of surprises on the show, aren't we?
We do have a few interesting things lined up in the weeks ahead. We will be travelling to Bhutan at some point.
Oh. My goodness.
We have a famous Canadian travel writer who is coming into our studio to talk about his bucket list in Australia.
Oh,
how funny.
Another
Canadian writer talking about his bucket list. We're going to learn stuff about our own country.
Well, it's about time.
So we've got that coming up. And look, you know, Stefan and I were cooking up all sorts of ideas before the show. So
you two are absolutely
tune
incredible.
In.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.